Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Sunday morning, I woke up to see the news that Juice WRLD had passed, and obviously it's become a very eerie feeling in the last couple of years to see members of the SoundCloud rap generation taken far too soon. You had Lil Peep, who died of an overdose a couple of years ago. XXXTentacion was murdered last year. As someone who has devoted a lot of energy and critical resource and time into this art form, it just never stops being painful. And I keep coming back to their ages and the fact that these are children. Juice was 21, but, you know, he'd putting records online for 4 or 5 years. These are kids, and they are dealt crazier hands than they have the tools to deal with. And yes, the circumstances for each of the individuals who died is very different, but each of them in some way came from having too much too soon and not being in a position to deal with that. And everybody raises their hand and says how terrible it is, but nobody raises their hand and says that they want to do something about it. I wrote a piece, started to ask a couple of those questions, and I would like to hear more about what should be done and what can be done. I understand that the circumstances vary widely, and not here trying to assign any specific blame, but I do think that anyone who works in this business and is invested in this art, not as a product, but as art, and who's invested in these people, these are people, these are not products, should have some part in trying to fix this. So this week on Bobcast, we're going to talk about the last 3 or 4 years on SoundCloud. David Turner's going to come through and we're going to talk about that. And then we're going to talk about the Peep documentary that came out a few weeks ago. It's called Everybody's Everything. The directors are going to call in. But mostly what we're going to talk about is, first of all, how did these artists get so big so fast? And then why were there no systems in place to help them when they needed it? I admit it, another hole got me finished. Broke my heart, oh no, you didn't. Fist open, I'ma down a whole bottle. Hard liquor, hard truth, can't swallow. Need a bartender, put me out my sorrow. Wake up the next day in the Monte Carlo with a new woman. Tell me bitch in Colorado when she loves. You just were listening to All Girls Are the Same, which is one of the first kind of breakout Juice WRLD records. It was a SoundCloud record and then was on Goodbye and Good Riddance, which is the first full-length album. I want to talk at a little bit of length about what's been happening for the last 3 or 4 years when SoundCloud rap became sort of something you can put in quotes, not merely a genre that appeared on a streaming service, but like a sort of standalone stylistic thing. Then I want to talk about, in the wake of Juice WRLD's passing, what can be done or what are some options. And someone I know who cares very deeply about both those things and was there at the beginning writing about this stuff when I was writing about it a few years ago, that's David Turner.
I'm back.
David's back.
Yo.
David, you know from covering all this stuff in 2017, and also you know, and if you don't know, you should know, Penny Fractions, which is his newsletter about the streaming business and the music industry's precipitous financial position. David's putting out, what are you putting out, a chapbook this week?
A chapbook, that's essentially it. Yes, I'll be putting out a short like essay that's just called New Music, a Solution to a Gig Economy, which will be looking at all the streaming fun.
Is it physical?
Yeah, I'm getting the physical copies tonight.
Yo, cop that. Everybody cop that. Penny Fractions is a newsletter. Subscribe to that, please. All right, David. So we've had a tumultuous 3 years, and it's important to talk about what was happening in 2015 and 2016 that first allowed this movement that we are now kind of like mourning a little bit to first catch fire. So I remember this is maybe early 2017 for me, but, you know, going on that first No Jumper tour with Pump and Perp. And at that time, I think XXXTentacion was in jail maybe at that time. But I remember just how big Look At Me was. And Look At Me had been big for quite some time at that point. But it was bigger when a DJ played it than any other thing that happened in any of those shows that I went to. Let's talk about that era and kind of what was fomenting, especially in South Florida at that time.
So you had X, you had Lil Pump, you had Smoke Perp, you had a number of these artists that were sort of making this, I guess, sort of post-3-6, like post, I'm going to give a shout out to like Bones and those kind of kids.
You beat me to it.
I'm sorry, I
you
beat
me
to
it.
Yeah, so there were a lot of artists.
Should I just address my haters right off the rip?
Just go for it.
Okay, fine. I mean, I was going to save this for like 5 minutes in, but to everybody on Twitter who is Bones Hive and Xavier Wolf Hive and Sesh Hollow Waterboys Hive, obviously, it's always very funny on Twitter when people assume that you don't know things that you very much know. So it should be said, when I refer to SoundCloud rap in the context of a piece at the New York Times, there are quotes around it. It is a standalone stylistic movement. It is not simply rap that appears on SoundCloud. It's not simply that. It is a stylistic micro moment that was given its most popular expression by what happened from these creators, especially, I mean, Juice is very nth wave.
Yeah.
But especially like X building off of a lot of that stuff that you just talked about.
Yeah.
And Peep kind of coming out of the more emo and punk traditions. But yes, I am aware no good deed goes unpunished. You spend the whole Sunday in your house ruminating about young artists taken too soon, only for some kid with 300 followers to be like, what about Bones? But so yes, Bones, shouts to Bones, who I just learned has a new album out. So go check that out.
Yeah, go check it. Also, I want to give a shout to Space Ghost Perp, who was just of like course. Doing all this about almost 10 years ago and really predated a lot of the scene that we see in South Florida.
And when you talk about Space Ghost Perp and Raider Clan, like obviously there's overlap between Raider Clan and Sesh Hollow Waterboys.
Yeah.
And then Raider Clan, a lot of that stuff, like you say, it's post-Memphis.
Yeah.
Like, and so there is a tradition. This is all coming out of a tradition. None of this stuff happens in a vacuum.
Absolutely not.
What happened that lit a fire in 2015, 2016?
So essentially what sort of lit a fire was that, I guess it was that X sort of blew.
Yeah.
That was sort of the big one, is that X blew, Look At Me, blew up. And sort of like, if you remember like the artwork was just sort of like him and his sort of like half black, half blonde braids, his image just sort of became the most striking image of this sort of early moment of SoundCloud rap. And it was because it was so abrasive. I think that's what was so striking about the music originally, was how abrasive it was.
Yeah.
I remember being at a radio station in Greensboro, North Carolina, and a DJ was just sort of like going through his emails and just sort of like found this track and was like, Look At Me, and tried to pronounce XXXTentacion's name, barely got it. But he was like, oh, and I was like, oh, have you guys played that? And he was like, oh, we could never play this on the radio.
No.
Never play this on the radio.
No, I mean, you know, the interesting thing about this scene is how it did end up sort of morphing into something that was quasi-melodic while still retaining this kind of rawness. But certainly that song did not fit with the prevailing trends of the day, the post-Drakeisms of the day.
No, or the early, like, Lil Pump, Smoke Perp. Like, it's still a little too rough around the edges at that point.
Man, can we just play D. Rose?
Oh, yeah.
Let's just play D. Rose.
Yeah, that was
fun. Oh, my God. It's what a great American song. Phenomenal. Hey, 100 on my wrist, 80 on my wrist. What? 100 on my wrist, 80 on my wrist. 100 on my wrist, 80 on my wrist. 100 on my wrist.
Morris, Eddie Morris, Deros, 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 Eddie Morris, Hunter Morris, what? Eddie Morris, Hunter Morris, Eddie Morris, what? Hunter Morris, Eddie Morris, Hunter Morris, Deros, 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 Hunter Morris, been a fan like Deros, Pop Foes, and I'm a fan like a hero. Superman, Lean got me like Rio, Rio, and my auntie on PO, PO, Morris, AD on a brick, Lil Pone never spent his money on a bitch, yeah, never, trust again, is he acting like a bitch, take a seat, beginning to the Motel 6, I just broke my wrist cause I'm whipping in the kitchen, you pass the bread to my mom and I told her whip it, well, 4 bands in the kitchen, 9 bands in the kitchen, I just see it, big what, I just broke my wrist, okay, I just froze it, baby. Okay. Deros, 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 Deros.
So basically, you had these kids coming out of South Florida who did have this kind of like aggressive, abrasive punk slash hardcore energy. X, in particular, out of that scene, had kind of like this polyvalent approach to creating music. Obviously, we also always have to caveat with X. X was accused of some terrible crimes in his short life, unresolved legal issues, and was a very divisive figure. There are millions and millions of people who pledged undying loyalty to him and his music, and then there are people who just absolutely refused to even engage with him because of the nature of his crimes. And that complicates his legacy, of course. So X Blue.
Yeah, but I think you're sort of getting to the point that when X Blue, his music was like what songs were sort of popping off for him were very abrasive and very sort of like extreme. But what ended up sort of happening over the years, as soon as his popularity started to get bigger, he started to, I don't want to say mellow out, but started to make slightly more melodic, slightly more varied music. He sort of would start having songs that were essentially, I don't want to say folk, but did have a slight like outsider sort of folk tinge to them.
I totally agree. I mean, I feel like maybe, was it Mark Richardson? Someone, I can't remember if this was on Twitter or even a conversation I had with him, who basically said like, if the first X album had basically come cold, like with no name attached to it, no nothing, it would almost feel like it came from a folk, like it could have come from a folk. Now, obviously, there are certain songs on it that wouldn't, but a lot of that music, because X really worked kind of sketch by sketch, a lot of those music were like sketches of lo-fi guitar, you know.
Yeah.
Alex G.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that's been interesting about X's posthumous music is that it's just sketches, because obviously these were not finished songs. He was, I don't think, in the studio of Rick Ross for any of that stuff, or like the numerous Lil Wayne songs he's done since.
I think they said that there was a Billboard article maybe about the making of. I think they sort of specifically said that they were doing that.
Yeah. So one of the things that is interesting about this music is I'll be honest, I don't particularly care for a lot of it, but it is very rough sketches.
Yep.
And the thing that you could sort of appreciate back when he was still alive and putting out this music is he was like working through the music and sort of working through ideas in real time, which is something that you could obviously see now with his contemporary of artists recording everything on Instagram Live.
Yes.
Or just sort of like taking up, just sort of like streaming all parts of their lives. But what was sort of become slightly frustrating with X's music since I've listened to it is that you don't get the sense that it's amounting to anything, because there's no next step. You're just sort of getting the last sort of fragments and pieces. One of the many upsetting things about this moment is that all these artists, what we're getting from them now are just sort of the last sort of like studio throwaways. And it's not like you can be a fan, you can enjoy the music, but it doesn't sort of resonate in the exact same kind of way.
Yeah. Although I did think about the X album that came out a week ago or 2 weeks ago, because they spent more time on it and because they did like paste these things into real songs, it did feel more substantive. There was something very hasty, I thought, about the previous
record.
That's what I'm getting at.
Like it's sort of odd to say, but X has had a number of post-death albums, but the most recent one is a little bit better put together. But that's sort of been something that obviously this is speaks also like Lil Peep, where we're sort of like, when you're listening to these songs, you're figuring out if this was something that was like fully fleshed out or if this is something that's sort of being restitched back together.
And speaking of Peep, like, you know, so X and Peep are sort of moving at the same time, kind of in parallel spaces. And in the same way that some of what X is doing draws upon this sort of like post-Raider Clan stuff, you know, there is a parallel emo first hip-hop adjacent movement happening on SoundCloud at the same time. You know, certainly like Nothing Nowhere and like, you know, all the, is it, what's the YouTube playlist? Astari?
Yes.
Yeah. So like a lot of that stuff. But Peep ends up being the one to get kind of like the first real heavy looks.
Yeah.
And him and X are in a weird way working very similar territory, just I feel like coming at it through opposite doors.
Yeah, I mean that there's some, I guess, being a kid of the suburbs, there's something not unsurprising that Peep comes from Long Island and that X is out in Florida.
Yeah.
Those two sort of like stylistic branches
and poles.
Poles end up sort of coming together and also like of the very few collaborations that they did.
Yeah. So SoundCloud rap, quote unquote, given where X was moving towards in like 2017,
yeah,
2018, and where Peep was in 2017, 2016, ends up kind of being little bit punk, little bit emotional, definitely melodic, lo-fi, somewhere on the lo-fi to totally abrasive spectrum.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. And that ends up becoming more of the standard than the kind of like,
yeah,
heavy hitting Ronnie J stuff. Basically, like the early Ronnie J stuff ends up becoming like archival.
Yeah, like that ends up being, you're correctly pointing out like the split that sort of happens, where it's like that stuff sort of gets left behind and it is the more melodic path that sort of that ends up surviving, which doesn't seem that surprising in the era of Drake, where it's like this decade, it's like, I know sometimes...
Speaking of people on Twitter...
I mean, I know some people don't like to admit that Drake influenced music at all,
because
never done that. But it's not surprising that if you have sort of a more abrasive sound and a more melodic sound in the 2010s, that's the more melodic sound ends up winning out. I mean, the same thing was happening even almost 10 years ago with Chief Keef. Chief Keef was going on two different kind of paths of music and ultimately ended up veering toward the more melodic path. But what people picked up an influence, and this is, we can hear in Juice WRLD, it's the melodic path,
yes,
not the more abrasive.
Unless you go to Rolling Loud, in which case you like Finito and have the lyrics tattooed. You have Gas What I Smoke tattooed across your chest.
I mean, that's the NLE chop, but that's a slightly different.
Yes.
which is actually interesting because it's not as big. There's a few artists and a few songs that hit like Finito and hit like that kind of stuff, but mostly melodic is sort of
absolutely
what ends up winning out.
Absolutely. And so X and Peep working kind of in parallel, but not really overlapping in any substantive way, at least not until after their death. I mean,
yeah,
we're getting to the part where people die. And this is, you know, this is an awful way to have to frame an era. I mean, you know, certainly in 96, 97, when Biggie and Pac got killed, like it felt like the end of something. You know, certainly when Kurt Cobain died, it felt like, you know, and there is something that was still germinating in this ecosystem. So Peep dies of a accidental overdose.
Yeah.
2017. X is murdered last year.
Yeah.
And now Juice has passed. Juice is very post X and post Keef in a way.
Yeah.
But Juice was also, and perhaps not surprisingly, the biggest pop success.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. Like, because Juice to me seemed to be the cleanest distillation. It's like absorbed everything that happened in 2015, 16, and 17, and then was like, yes, and I make beautiful pop songs.
I think when All Girls Are the Same and his next biggest hit, Lucid Dreams, came out, I saw a lot of comments of people being like, oh my gosh, the Black Post Malone, which could be a horrific insult or, to me, a great compliment.
Yes.
Because
this is a Post Malone safe space.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
This is one that's a good pod. But yeah, no. But Juice WRLD kind of had sort of a Post Malone, very melodic approach to music. And I think one of the things that...
Speaking of folk singers.
Again, a very similar setup. I mean, the other thing, I think one of the things that I think has been spoken to before is that a lot of these artists are pulling from a lot of the same influences.
Yeah.
In much in the same way I think of artists, this is a bit of feel, but I'm going to make it, is that like the way 100 Gex, you can listen to them and feel 1,000 different artists of influence. With a Juice WRLD and a Post Malone, you can maybe hear folk, maybe you can hear rap, maybe you can hear like a Nickelback or a Creed, but you can hear all these different things because ultimately for a lot of these artists, when they are just sort of going on the more melodic route, they can sort of just like hop between these things. in the same song or just within like an entire album. You get like Juice's last album, you got maybe like 17 different styles.
Yeah. A little known thing about 100 Gex is each of the 1,000 Gex of their album title is a different musical influence.
I mean,
one Gex equals one musical influence. It's just not something they talk about, but you know, just keep in mind. Juice WRLD, yes, and to your point about the second Juice WRLD record, which I don't think is as effective as the first Juice WRLD record, but
I disagree. I like the messiness of it. That's the thing. I think one of the things about this era that I will say, I think art that fans, especially younger fans, start to appreciate more is that the cohesiveness of a project is a little bit less exciting than hearing your favorite artist just try different thing after different thing.
So this is called, it's called Death Race for Love. This is the second record, came out in March, I think, March or April. What's a song on here that you think was a good experiment?
I liked Big, because Big essentially was him being Chief Keef. And also it has one of my favorite trends of 2019, which is referencing old school Gucci Mane, because he references the Wilt Chamberlain tape, which is a real actual Gucci deep cut.
Yes, and Juice WRLD's was a rap nerd.
Yeah.
All right, let's listen to a little bit of Big. We can sit here and celebrate the last few years of music and kind of mourn the loss of these people. But anybody who read the piece I wrote on Sunday, anybody who saw what David was tweeting about this weekend, you know, there is a heavy moral component that I feel, even though people who we know maybe are talking about it, I feel like isn't getting quite as much attention. And I wanted to draw attention to it in the piece because I feel like, look, these are children, right? Maybe they're 21 or 20, but like these are people who started in the music business or posting songs when they were 16, 15, 17. And, you know, certainly in the case of Juice WRLD, got very famous very fast.
Yeah.
X as well, although X was in jail, much more complicated situation. And Peep, as you see in the documentary, was dealing with it in the same way. And I'm really spending a lot of time thinking about not just drug use, but mental health. And whose responsibility is it to look after these kids? You know, I'm cynical about the music business and the industry and how it treats young performers, especially young performers who are not white. This is something that I spend a lot of energy concerned about and have a lot of conversations about in my real life, and had a lot of text message and DM chains this weekend with people who were also similarly frustrated. And, you know, I was looking at an article on Hits Daily Double today about, like, you know, it's like the year-end album thing, year-end, like, label, who made the most money? And I'm looking at a picture of Lucian Grange. They made, you know, some untold millions of dollars this year. And I'm like, does Lucian need to put like $1 million in the account and that $1 million or on the budget and that $1 million goes to mental health counseling, substance abuse counseling for your artists? You know how the music business works. Explain to people what these are like free agents, right? Like, let's structure it. Like, you know, Juice WRLD is not an employee of a record label. He has a contract for services. He has a contract.
I mean, so that's sort of the thing that I've been struggling with, I think, for at least a year, just being a little bit more inside of the industry as I've gotten. But it's that
Should we disclose briefly?
Yeah.
Okay, so David, independent of, you know, David, if you listen to Podcast Raw, you know David's been up here before and has been writing in a bunch of places. But David has been doing some editorial work for SoundCloud, unconnected to anything that we're talking about today. But, we, you know, just the interest of disclosure, throwing it out there.
Yeah.
But anyway, now that you've seen it up close.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, and I mean, I've known this, I mean, I sort of inferred this because I was just a music fan. You read about how the record industry has worked for over a century, you kind of get, you sort of pick up on the pieces. But it's that artists are signed, and I think one thing that people think is when artists are signed, you're getting like a crew, or you get people that are like watching you every day, or like keeping track to see how you're doing. That's not really, really quite
you mean from the label? That's
from the
how
label
it's,
side.
Right, but
yeah,
that's
and
not...
I think even from fans, I think fans sort of see like an artist sign a piece of paper surrounded by dozens of people. And they're like, oh, my gosh, they now have like an entire like team
in
behind
zip
them.
Zip neck sweaters.
Yeah. But what do they really get? They get maybe someone that'll help with some studio space, maybe some people that'll help with like touring, and maybe some people that'll sort of just help with sort of like the finances. But that's really it. And
yeah.
And in a world where you are all of a sudden flush with cash, you have everyone sort of coming up to you. I mean, I was reading a profile of Juice WRLD earlier today that was done by Molly Lambert and Vulture that was very good. And one thing that he was sort of saying was this sort of frustration of like, he's now out in Los Angeles and he can't go back home. And Molly writes sort of saying that that's not an abnormal thing for someone to experience. Like, you're in your late teens or early 20s, you travel, you leave home. But for Juice, he sort of made the point of like, but I would like to go back home. But because when I go home, I am not myself. I am now Juice WRLD. People know who I am. People might want to get something out of me. People might be angry at me.
Yeah,
and
people
all of a sudden
might.
Just, yeah.
He's a target.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also, you know, when I interviewed Juice last year, you know, it's important to say Juice was like, he was a very sweet, soft-edged kid. You know, let's just keep it a buck. You know, he's not a tough kid. But, you know, he had a normal rapper entourage, you know, it's a bunch of guys, you know how it is, some tough guys. And like some of that's practical because you never know who might want to test. It's like reminding me of early Drake.
Yeah.
Like you looked at early Drake and people maybe wanted to test early Drake.
Yeah.
And then Drake turned into the Terminator.
I mean, that was a transformation. But yeah. To again reference like X, how did X go? He was like shot in a parking lot. And that was a thing that was, he was keeping a very, very low profile compared to like his fame at that point. He was very low profile. So it's very understandable that you have sort of those kind of concerns. But I think sort of the broader point that he was sort of just making was just mentally, because he talked a lot about mental health, was just that like he just couldn't go home. And I think it's like not being able to return home, not be able to find some sense of normalcy as everything else in your life is changing, is really, really hard on just anyone. If you go to college, if you just like leave home, that's like a hard experience for a lot of people. And even more so when you have essentially every part of your life sort of upended, and then you all of a sudden have people whispering in your ear like, hey, this is going to be number one record, where's your next hit going to come from?
And right, there's a combination of this kind of like internal pressure of like, I want the trains moving, I want to keep it moving as fast as it's moving. External pressure from whether it's family or friends or people who are leeching off of you or whatever, being like, you're the money guy, like it's like, yeah, we all roll with you, but like it's on your dime. And then there are labels who in this point are basically like sentient algorithms who obviously, and look, I've never worked at a record label. I don't want to impugn every single person who works at a record label, but I also know like, look, if you are Joey IE and you're running Interscope, if you're Tom at Warner, Paul at Def Jam, Peter at RCA, all people with immense resources at their disposal and who I would imagine at this point are hopefully, I hope, email me, DM me, thinking about how they can bring some mental health services or the like into their relationships with their artists who undoubtedly would love to have access to them. Like if you're any of these guys, mostly guys, there are women, there are some women, but primarily
guys.
Men, you know, if you're John Janik, like if you're one of these people, I understand that technically your musicians are not your employees. You do not extend them healthcare. Like, I understand structurally that's how it's worked. But do you want to find yourself in a situation where one of these people who you are contracted with and who has the potential to do incredible, just be capitalist about it, like just do big business, is left this vulnerable? How is that good business?
I mean, that's a question I just sort of think I've been thinking a lot about, where it's sort of like on a very basic level. I mean, I might have my own personal feelings on this, where I was like, they be employees in my universe, to be perfectly honest.
No, of course.
Yeah, but I guess on the other level is just sort of that.
Shout out to Democratic Socialists.
but my point is just that, like, the reason why is just so you bring people in and so you care a little bit more, and because in that way. I think of this often. I won't say who, but I remember just sort of like chatting with someone at a record label who was talking about an artist, and they were just very frank, being like, "That artist has problems, and I don't want to like work with that artist." And I just remember sort of thinking to myself, like, "That's I don't know if I'm supposed to be feel good about that though." Like, not that you. I mean, maybe it's good that you say that you have like a line that you don't want to bring someone into your circle, but like, who's looking out for that person? Because if you're saying no, does that mean there's going to be someone else that's just going to see like? See dollar signs with that person, sees problem but does not want to help them. And the industry seemingly would not either care either way, honestly.
Yeah, and that's, you know, look, I'm really heartened when I see things like Smoke Perp getting sober or has been at least in much better health. You know, Lil Pump has talked about getting sober on a few occasions. It seems like this time it seems to be maybe sticking a little bit more, although he did then post a picture of himself at a dispensary. So, you know, but, you know, maybe sober in all other ways. Maybe hopefully. There's, is there a thing called weed sober? There's probably
I think that's California. There's a California.
California thought. Sober.
That thing's California.
Okay. So then we'll give it a pass. But, you know, stuff like that I find heartening. But I also don't know. I feel like I've spent a lot of time in the last 24 hours trying to think of a system that could be universalized in the record business. And maybe it is that the heads of the labels do have to create line items in their budget.
Yeah.
It's like, look, you're making millions and millions and millions of dollars. You can siphon off $500,000 or $1 million for access to that kind of counseling. Now, I also am aware, having seen what it's like on the inside with some of these kids as it's going.
Yeah.
I understand how hard it would be, especially when the label has no presence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you look at someone like Juice or one of these kids, like, it's him, his managers, his crew, and then there's like a maybe an A&R person like in the corner. So it's not really like the label has heavy, heavy presence. But maybe it should be a standard of contracts to basically include something like this. I don't know. You know, I'm not a lawyer, not a record executive. I'm a person that doesn't want vulnerable young musicians to die as a result of the pressures and circumstances that the record business places them in.
Yeah, and I think that's something that like is worth continuing to sort of talk to and sort of think through. But I think one thing is you're correct that it is a little hard because some artists actually do have a lot more of the label connected to them. It is a thing where like certain artists are just sort of left off on their own. And I think within rap, we might be a little bit more just attuned to it because we've seen over the last couple of years especially that like some artists just get signed for like a song or two. And it's just like, well, we're really just here to distribute your song so you can make a little
there's
more
a lot
money.
Of, there's a lot of like what I think of as like roulette betting
in
contemporary rap. Algo driven. We'll give so-and-so $50,000 or $100,000 and like throw a little money at production and like see what happens. And I understand like if you do that for 50 artists, can you also provide all those services to those people? I mean, look, I don't know the answer.
I don't know the books.
I don't know the books. I don't know the answer to that question. But I do know that if I was an executive at a label in business with, whether in a employee or in a contract sense, with someone like this who then falls victim to sort of this awful fate, I don't want that on my soul.
I mean, a thing I've sort of thought, I was telling this to someone yesterday where an thought that keeps sort of recurring through my mind is that if I was at a record label or if I just like any kind of job in this context where it's like, oh, if this is what I'm signing up for is to like one day I'll get the phone call or see the text that leads to this where like someone that we're working heavily with has passed away in this context. I just don't know if I could come into work every day. Just to be very real. Like after a point, it's just sort of like I have to like know where money is coming from. And if I know that was it, that'd be really hard to do. And I think this decade, just to like, because it's the end of the decade and all that stuff, I want to say one thing.
I'm glad you know that.
I want to say one thing is that like there has been change in this in the music industry. One thing I do want to say is because artists like Demi Lovato, Selena Gomez, Justin Bieber, there have been a lot more artists that have been sort of willing to speak to that, even on a much smaller scale. I think of it was like Mitski, who just said like, oh, I'm just going to be away now. Like I played my last show at Central Park. I'll see you guys whenever I feel like.
Creating a boundary that's a safe space. And again, I don't know how much of this is the label, how much of this is managers, how much of this is even publicity companies. Like, I feel like everybody has a role to play. Yeah. Anyway, if you are an executive and you are listening to this and you are going to do something about this, I would actually really love to hear from you. You can email me at podcast@nytimes.com, and those of you who are in my DMs, you can hit me. But the fact remains that this problem remaining unsolved or unaddressed, we're all going to be feeling the repercussions of that for years to come.
Yeah.
Hey, man, thanks for coming through.
No,
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Let's go out with a good recent Juice WRLD song. Let's listen to Bandit, Juice WRLD, and NBA Youngboy. Good, I could do better. Bad chick from the woods, I think she a hunter. She a killer and a eater, she a Jeffrey Dahmer. I could tell when she in the feelings, I could read her like a book. No tech, no Beretta, effing on me, am I understood? Yeah. I don't need no Molly to be savage. When I'm on that Molly, I feel savage. She the definition of a bad bitch. I'm the definition of a bandit. I don't need no Molly to be savage. Hey, but when I'm on the Molly, I feel savage. Hey, my girl the definition of a bad bitch. It stole her heart. I'm the definition of a bandit. My brother point her out and she a bad bitch. Must get on her. Must ain't heard that I'm a savage once I get up. Bitch, I own her. I see she got swag, I got cash, so I want her. See this 4-5 in my pants, put on your ass with your own, bro. Shorty, she's a rider with the glizzy on her. And shorty, I'm a daughter with no semi on me. If we got a problem, we get rid of homie. Put 20,000 in your pocket, we gon' get the money. I'm the definition of a bandit. Took your heart from out his hands and still ain't saying shit. Some new killers in my circle you done ran with. Like this 30-38, this bitch get damaged. Popping Willis, 4K Trey Call when you land with it.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dio, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. I developed this recipe when I was down in Georgia with my family. It stars a Korean red pepper powder called gochugaru. I love the way it blooms in the maple syrup and the rice vinegar. If you don't have gochugaru, you should totally get some. It's super versatile. It's not just that it brings heat, but fruity sweetness as well. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Now we're going to pivot into sort of the second part of this week's episode, picking up on a similar theme. I'm not sure if you guys have had the chance to see Everybody's Everything, which is the recent Lil Peep documentary that came out a few weeks ago. I wrote about it as part of the SoundCloud Rap piece this weekend. I was really struck in that film by basically what David and I were just talking about, that tension of here's this kind of out of control fame thing that's happening, but also like no systems are really in place or not good systems are in place to kind of nurture and support emotionally and health-wise the person who is the engine of fame. And this film really captures both of those things really well. And so I wanted to talk to the guys who directed it about those narrative choices in the film and also kind of what it was like to learn about that in the real-time making of the film. So we've got on the phone, we got Ramez Silian, a.k.a. Mezzy, and Sebastian Jones dialing in from different landlines in other parts of the country. What's up, guys?
Hello.
Hey, man.
Hey, thanks for being here. I really appreciate it. Like, as I was just saying, that seems to be the central tension. I mean, your film, it's a biography of Peep, but there is this tension, and particularly in the second half, between this runaway success and everything around him starting to collapse. And Sebastian, was that the story to you when you first walked in the door? Did you know that's the story you were telling? Or how did you decide to give it the kind of level of play that you ended up giving it?
Well, the guiding principle, you know, coming into this, and the title was something I decided on pretty early, and it stayed true to the experience of making the film, and it kept coming up, was this idea of him wanting to be everybody's everything. So that was like a central idea, but, you know, as you're making the film, you realize that there's these other stories too, and exactly what you were pointing out, that was something that, yeah, it was hard to ignore this, like, and as, like, you know, Travis Mills says it in the film, the speed in which this all came together, it was like a blur. Nobody was really checking to make sure there were some breaks, that there were some systems in place.
The title phrase, which comes from a peep, I forget, was it a IG caption or a text message or?
Instagram caption.
Instagram caption, yeah. But that phrase really encompasses both sides of the tension, because you wouldn't need to be everybody's everything if you weren't the person who was successful and everyone was relying upon, and then ultimately like leeching energy from at the same time. So very, very apt title. Was there a thought at any point of making that more of the focus of the film? Because obviously you have this part, the first half, which is more his childhood and some of the difficulties that he had growing up. Was there ever a time when the movie was going to be more focused on the 2015 to 2017 era as opposed to his whole life?
I don't know. I mean, I think both of us really felt that we wanted it to be about Gus's life at large, and that accounts for so much more than just those years. And so we were really committed to making sure that part of the story was told and that we did that justice, you know, his growing up and in the early years.
Yeah, it was important to sort of humanize him as a person first and see his rise and his maturation into a, you know, young adult before we sort of dipped into, oh, and by the way, this is, you know, where he's going.
Yeah.
So showing that progression was so much more important because there are people who may watch this film who, you know, haven't heard a song of his. And sort of introducing him as Gus, first and foremost, was definitely always on the agenda.
And also humanity. I mean, you said humanize, and I think that's really important. In the first part of this episode, I was speaking with David Turner, who had written a lot about SoundCloud rap, and we were talking about how record labels increasingly have difficulty viewing the artists they work with as people, you know, their products, their algorithm, you know, their stream totals, et cetera, but are they humans? And that's something that can be a little hit or miss, I think, in the music business. So I think you're right to say you want to create a setup where we understand that Peep, who he was as a person before we arrive at, because that way, when we arrive at the moment where his success comes, you're rooting for him because you know where he's coming from, and you see just how striking a jolt it is coming from where he came from and sort of his early, you know, his early life.
I think it's so important to make the distinction that there is a difference depending on the lens you're looking through between Gustav R and Lil Peep.
Yeah.
And Lil Peep tends to be that product, you know, that he's at some point he just becomes something that needs to be monetized, and then Gustav sort of fades away. And that's part of that tension going back to everybody's everything. Like, at what point does he not want to be Lil Peep anymore? You know, how does he turn that off?
Right. And did you get the sense, was he able to, like, especially in the 2016-2017 window, Mezzi, were there moments where he was able to turn it off, like, based on, you know, whether it's stuff that made it into the film or just stuff that you guys encountered along the way? Were there times that he was able to take it off?
To me, I don't think he had figured that out yet. Again, to go back to that tension, he was so excited by how the reaction he was getting from people and how much they gravitated towards Lil Peep. But at the same time, I think he went through these periods of how do I balance this? How do I disappear for a little bit? How do I care for myself, really, when there's an endless amount of people and line items to get to, inhuman amount of work to be done?
You're triggering a memory for me when I interviewed Liza, who's Peep's mom, writing about the posthumous record. And she was talking about a time, I can't remember the specific time frame, but where Peep did come back to Long Island to spend a couple of days. And then he got rousted out of it and had to basically get pulled back into the, you know, into the vortex, and how agonizing it was for him to kind of not be able to find space for himself in the midst of all of this. When you were interviewing people, and you interviewed really widely, it seems, when you were interviewing people, how keyed in to that did you get the sense that the people who were working with him, how keyed into that were they? Did they realize how heavy his internal tug of war was at that time?
I think very few.
Yeah.
There were definitely a handful that did. You know, his family, a few people that were trying to guide him through the storm. But I think he was such a person that didn't even want to put that on others. You know, I don't know if he even spoke about it with most of his peers. And I don't think, you know, I don't even try to, it's not even to put any blame. It's just a sense of maybe there were, a lot of them were also too young to sort of understand the situation.
In all of these situations, you know, the people who are in charge are often young, or they don't have as much experience as maybe they should, or, and that is striking when it's like, you know, babies having babies and it's unclear where the kind of like moral compass comes from or the kind of ethical compass comes from. It's certainly something from the outside looking in that I always think about. I did feel like a couple of his collaborators who you interviewed seemed to understand, especially those who knew him kind of maybe in the very early days, like the Schema Posse days and so on and so forth. Some people who knew him from the earliest days seemed to grasp the challenges that he was facing during that later period in 2016 and 2017. What kinds of things did you learn about Peep from those folks and from that time period, like the 2015 time period?
Certainly a lot of people had different, you know, and some people could articulate these challenges of being young and so talented and accelerating so fast. And some of those guys definitely understood the challenges. I mean, and Ghostmane too, you know,
yeah.
he would often, I mean, he's going through it himself, you know, he's a young guy accelerating fast. And so, it was really interesting to get like a perspective from some of these guys who are also simultaneously going through it and seeing, being so self-aware about those challenges.
We all want to make, I don't want to say a laudatory film about Peep, because it's not necessarily that you want to make a laudatory film, but you want to honor him. And yet so much of what happened in the latter part of his life was kind of like rife with this kind of tension. And I wonder, as filmmakers, you know, as you're interviewing people and as you're learning more and more and more, how much of a challenge was it for you guys as all this new information is coming in that deepen the story and add texture to the story, but also make it much darker and much, much more anxiety inducing? What was that like for you guys as that was unfolding?
I mean, it's tough. I mean, it was a tough story to tell, but it's kind of like, thank goodness there was, you know, the family side of the story and also Jack and his letters. I mean,
Peep's grandfather.
Yeah. And so that gave things a hopeful direction in the midst of all the darkness. And you know, Mezzi had, you know, known a lot of these people prior. I was kind of coming in as I knew about Gus through his family, but I didn't know anything about the dynamics between him and his friends or him and his management or any of that. So I was learning about it along the way. I mean, it was really sad to see how dark it really got.
Did you ultimately feel like the true way to honor him was to render the story kind of in its full complexity? I mean, I'm sure there's stuff that was darker than what's in the film that did not make it in, but to render the kind of full tension of it, did that seem like ultimately the most ethical way to honor him?
Yeah, because it's an incredibly complex story. So to tell it with that nuance was important, and to let it be pretty raw and unfiltered, that was important. I didn't want to gloss over how dark parts of that story are.
And I also, to add, would say that all of that complication and nuance is, I think, adds to the sense of how the viewer feels when they're sort of enduring the story. A lot of this stuff is just presented. You know, you refer to a section in the piece of the film in which you're seeing this like push and pull between the music industry and his family and his ideals, and that section specifically is just presenting you, trying to get you in that headspace of where he's at. It's not necessarily, the film itself isn't commenting on how personal opinion, it's you take what you want from that complexity. You draw it out. And I think that's very important.
Given that the story became, you know, so much so complex and that there was all this tension that you guys were learning about through the course of your interviews, how hard was it for you to kind of stay focused and true to the story that you needed to tell without kind of feeling like external pressures from every involved party? Because I'm sure everybody involved in it had a version of it that they wanted to have told. How did you guys stay focused on your version, your story?
The title was like incredibly important in this. Like, this is the central theme, and like what tells this story is what helps to support that thesis is like kind of what floats to the top and the rest falls away. But, you know, yes, I mean, people had very strong opinions surrounding it. And, you know, kind of being an outsider to the thing, it was my job to kind of come in and be objective and parse my way through that. We both felt this, that we didn't want the thing to turn into like a true crime story, and that would overshadow the film being about Gus's life and him as a person. But yes, it was strong opinions and all of that, but I had the creative control to make sure that the film stayed on track and we didn't get too swayed into any one camp.
You know, I've been thinking a lot, obviously, with the passing of Juice WRLD, and thinking a lot about responsibility, not in a micro level, but in a big picture level, that like, here we are moving in a music industry that doesn't cater to the mental health of the people who are the famous people who provide, you know, all the creativity and all the art. And I wonder if with you guys having had access to talking to all these people, talking to the artists, the collaborators, the people at the management company, Peep's family, what do you guys think? Where's the responsibility lie? Do you think that there should be more structural responsibility built in to the music business? Like, now that you've seen it a little bit up close, do you think that the record business could do more to sustain the mental health of its performers? And based specifically on the interactions and conversations that you had for this film.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone can do more.
Other creative industries have a lot more safeguards. Like, you look at our industry, we've got numerous, you know, WGA, DGA, there's unions, and artists, specifically musicians, who like lead these extremely grueling schedules, probably yep. more so than any artist out there. They don't have any of that. And I think that's a start. Something like that is a start. Someone they can call, and maybe, you know, a third party to arbitrate, or if they feel it taken advantage of, or you know, maybe they just don't feel well, but some people aren't taking no for an answer, whether it's management or fans or, you know, friends. You know, you see it over and over again where the first no is not really, it's not accepted usually.
Yes, right. Yeah, and, you know, I hate that. I just feel like every year it's just one cautionary tale after the next. I'm grateful for the film that you guys made, because at least it renders that cautionary tale with complexity and with beauty. But it doesn't feel good that we all had to go through that in order to arrive at this. Guys, I appreciate you calling in and chatting with me about this today.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
We haven't listened to any Peep yet today, so let's go out with something off Crybaby. Let's go with 19. That is our show. I really hope if anybody's listening that works and works in the record business in any kind of executive or managerial capacity, I hope that you are thinking about the mental well-being of your artists and the people that you work with. It remains shocking to me that we have to talk about this over and over and over again. This should be part of the conversation every single day. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content. And email us, podcast@nytimes.com. I'm curious to hear people's experiences, either working or from artists or working with artists in the business, and where the holes are that can be patched. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week.